Hello, this is Marius from TradeMate Sports, and with me I have...
Alex again, mate, same as always.
Yep.
Back for episode 9, exciting stuff.
That's going to be good. We have a lot of ground to cover in this episode, but it's going to be a lot of fun. So.
Yes, as always, mate. And we'll kick things off with the quiz question of the week. This week, it's I think it's quite an easy one, but I actually struggled a bit. Who got relegated in last season of the EPL? It seems like an easy question when you first say it, but when you think about it, I was like, oh, God, who did get relegated last year?
Yeah, I really have to think about that one because, you know, I try to focus on, like, the top of the table. But
yeah, I wonder why.
I guess I'll have a guess.
Yeah, at the end. All right. And this week, I thought we'd kick things off a bit different. Normally, we're always talking about EPL, but there are actually two, I think, very exciting things that happened outside the world of EPL this week. The first one's quite an interesting one because it relates to you a little bit, mate.
Yeah.
A Norwegian superstar by the name of, I think you're probably the better man to pronounce it,
Erling Braut Haaland, who scored a hat-trick. And, I mean, there have been other people who have scored a hat-trick in their debuts before, yeah, but I don't think there's too many people who have been scoring hat-tricks coming in as a substitute.
Yeah.
So it was just crazy. It took him like 3 minutes to score the first goal, and the first two goals were brilliant. The second goal was, the first and the last goal were brilliant. The second goal was a tap-in. But it just sort of shows like what an excellent finisher he is. Mm-hmm. And he really is just so clinical when he gets those chances. He has the speed that's necessary to sort of get the time required to get those good finishes in too. And I'll touch a bit upon him in my fearless predictions for the future. But overall, like, I just think he is an absolute amazing striker. And he's gone for the very top. And it was actually a bit surprising to me that not more teams than United, Dortmund and Leipzig were fighting for his signature this spring. Because that 20 million euro buyout clause just looks absolutely ridiculous now, not having cashed that out. Mm-hmm. So that is just very surprising. I really wished Liverpool were in for him. Also because it would have been a lot of fun to have another Norwegian at the club. It's been a while since Risa, who was the last one. But it's like even if you don't need a striker, then the 20 million euros is just peanuts for most clubs these days.
Yeah.
And he's just so good. That being said, he probably wouldn't have gone to a club where he wasn't going to be like a first choice striker.
Yeah.
Because his dad and Raiola have been pretty good advisors to him so far. Like, his career trajectory has just been absolutely perfect. Starting out with Molde, getting game time, scoring like 4 goals in a game as a 16-year-old playing in the Norwegian league. Then moving on to Salzburg and getting game time there, scoring, I don't know, 30 goals so far this season, and getting his shot in the Champions League and just really being able to dominate there. Then taking the next step to Dortmund, still like getting playing time and keep on developing, and then finally he'll make probably at least one more big move when he's been at Dortmund for a couple of years. That's probably why he has that big buyout clause inserted into his contract that kicks in 2 years. Yeah. So I guess the plan is for him to stay at Dortmund for at least 2 years. Then someone will probably have to put like 100 million on the table to buy him out. And then he'll go to one of the top clubs, like the Madrids, Barcelonas, or hopefully Liverpool, but I don't really see them buying superstars. They prefer to make superstars themselves these days.
It was a gutsy call from Haaland to go to Borussia Dortmund, I think, because out of the three clubs that were pursuing him, you had Manchester United. It was going to be hard for him to get established into that team. Also with Werner from Leipzig, that was also going to be hard. So I think Borussia Dortmund was probably the best club for him to go to if he was going to leave, because you got Paco Alcácer, I think his name is there, probably not as well established as the other two teams. But still, like, I remember me and you saying that, like, we wouldn't mind if he just stayed in Austria for, you know, at least the rest of this season.
Yeah.
And just keep applying his trade. But it will be interesting to see how he goes from here on out, because I think it is a gutsy call to go to Borussia Dortmund this early in his career. But I mean, it seems like he's quite the superstar. The way he finished off those, like, the first goal and the third goal, that's like, you know, that's what you want out of your striker, to be hitting those kind of chances in. So, amazing buy for Dortmund. If he keeps going the way he's going, they're going to make a lot of money off him, or they're going to win some trophies with him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, exciting times for Norway, mate.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, exciting thing that happened in the world of sports that's not in the EPL was Conor McGregor. He got himself back on track, mate. I know you're not the biggest fight fan, but I am a bit of a UFC fan, and I've been watching a lot of UFC over the years. Not the biggest Conor McGregor fan, just because of all the stuff he's done outside of, you know, his fighting career. But I guess it was good to see him get back on track. He had a completely different demeanor throughout fight week last week. I don't know if he was trying, if it was an act or not, but he was kind of being as good of a bloke as you can be, just trying to be a nice guy for once. I think the funny thing out of all of this is that for people, that, you know, Conor McGregor, like, is a massive star, and he transcends MMA. So, like, when he fights, it's not just like your standard mixed martial arts fans watching. It's people that, you know, they're just tuning in to watch Conor McGregor. And the sad thing was that no one knows his opponent, Donald Cerrone, is, like, literally, like, a legend of MMA. And the way that he dispatched of him made him look like he is just an absolute nobody. Like, the guy that he was facing, Donald Cerrone, is, like, just an absolute legend. He holds so many records, like the most wins in UFC history, most head kick knockouts. He's a legend. Although he's never been a champion, like, he's about as good as you can get in terms of never being a champion. So I felt so sorry for him, because you know, he lasted 40 seconds.
For the guys like me, I mean, the MMA fights I have watched, I thought it was pretty cool, I have enough with one sport that I follow. But I'm curious, like, what is it that makes McGregor so good that he's able to sort of knock out one of the legends in just 40 seconds? What was, like, his advantage?
He's an incredible striker, mate. Mm-hmm. He's a very, very good striker.
And that's in punches, kicks, or both?
Both. Yeah. He's just very well rounded with his striking game. Most, I'd probably say, he's more of a puncher than a kicker. Mm. But the problem with mixed martial arts, and the reason why he's lost a lot over the years, is because it's also, you've got to factor in things like wrestling, jiu-jitsu, grappling, all those kind of things, kickboxing, like. And he's not as well rounded as people think he is. Everyone thinks he's, like, you know, this incredible fighter just because his name's the biggest, you know what I mean? Like someone like Mike Tyson, he had his flaws, but people think he's, like, the best ever because his name's Mike Tyson. So, yeah, so he's come undone against certain fighters like Khabib Nurmagomedov, the guy that he lost to a year and a bit ago, just because he's a straight wrestler. And in MMA, if you're a good wrestler versus a good striker, normally the wrestler wins, just because they can dictate what happens.
Yeah.
They can just grab you and, you know, drive you into the ground and keep you there for the whole round. So he's not even close to one of the best MMA fighters, I don't even think. But it was a good stylistic matchup for him, because Cerrone's a bit of a – his nickname's Cowboy, so he loves to just get in there and fight. And he wanted to stand up with McGregor. And that's not a good recipe against McGregor, because he's a sensational striker.
Yeah, so you got to attack his weaknesses if you want to beat him.
Yeah, you have to have I mean, Cerrone can grapple, but you have to want to grapple, and you have to obviously be a very good wrestler to be able to take McGregor down and do your work from there. So it was a good matchup for him. Like I predicted in my value bet, he would win knockout first round. But going forward, I wouldn't expect the same sort of results from Conor McGregor, depending on the opponent, obviously. Don't get too excited yet. He's got a lot bigger and better opponents to beat. But I guess it's good to have him back. It's very good for the sport. It's very good for the sport.
Yeah.
He's a massive name. Yeah, we can move on from the UFC, mate. And we can talk about your your Liverpool again. Another victory. I say this every week. Not that exciting. But it was a massive game against Manchester United, so I'd love to hear your take on the game.
I thought it was a very good game. Some of the games we've had against Manchester United over the recent seasons, I found a bit boring. Because it's been one team trying to attack and one team just trying to defend a lot of the time. But in this game, like, United had some pretty good chances and they could easily have scored at least one goal. It's not like the easiest chances to finish off, especially like the Pereira one, where he just didn't like get there in time. If he had got there, he would have scored. But yeah, getting on the end of that brilliant cross is difficult. And he didn't quite manage to get it. And then Martial also had an amazing, amazing chance. That was a beautiful play, like interchange between him and Pereira. And then the finish was just like too much power. If you just controlled it a bit more, because the far post side of the goal was quite open. So if you had controlled it a bit more, he could have been able to just like slot it in there. But I've noticed this a couple of years ago with David De Gea, and whenever Liverpool were playing them, because he was so good, like that was when he was at the absolute peak of his powers and just saving plus 10 expected goals like every season for the team. The players sort of, they knew he was so good that they always put this extra effort into trying to beat him. So they would like always go for like, I need to hit like the crossbar and down into the goal in the top corner for it to be a goal. That's like the only way to beat De Gea. You just gotta place it in a place where you can't reach it. And it sort of felt a bit the same to me with Martial and a couple of the other United finishes yesterday, that Alisson is so good and they know it, so they try to really like put that extra effort into finding the top corner in order to beat him. And by trying to do so, they actually just missed the goal instead. So that's United's chances. Then, I mean, Liverpool had that goal, which got disqualified. I try to leave those things up to the referee in general. I think that the goalkeepers are a bit too much protected. Because I heard Gary Neville say that it wasn't a free kick, which I found pretty interesting coming from Gary Neville. But I was watching the game with a friend of mine who's a United fan and who has done refereeing and taken refereeing courses and stuff like that. And he says that if the goalkeeper has 10 fingers on the ball, then it's a free kick. So that's just the rules. So I guess that one was pretty okay, despite, yeah.
I think I slightly favour United in this situation, but seriously, De Gea had 10 fingers to the ball, like you said. He should have held on to it. And Van Dijk, it didn't look like he was trying very hard to get the ball. So on that basis, I think I would side with De Gea. The thing I got out of all of it was the way they... I mean, it's like a common thing in football, isn't it? The way they ran up to the ref and, like, it's disgraceful, I think. Like, at the end of the day...
They're coming from rugby.
Oh, mate, I cannot believe the way they treat the ref. Like, if I was a ref, I would just be like, oh, see you later. There's your red card for you for speaking to me like that. I just think it's disgraceful the way they treat him. Like, because the problem is... It's not the way you treat the ref in the EPL. It's the way that then a kid watching that game, you know, a five-year-old kid watching his Manchester United team play and seeing his favourite player, De Gea, run up to a referee like that, then he's going to go and replicate that on the weekend to some poor bloke who's volunteering his time. I don't care how bad the call is or whatever. You don't run up to someone like that and get in their face and scream. It's just, I think it's disgraceful personally. But
I mean, it was also quite obvious that VAR was going to have a look at that goal. So why make all those protests?
I mean, maybe it's fair enough because they know VAR is absolutely useless. So they just want the referee to make the right call. But I think it's poor, mate. Like, I just think Manchester United versus Liverpool is arguably the biggest fixture in the whole of football, like every year, like two of the biggest clubs in the whole world. Imagine the amount of kids that are watching that game.
Yeah.
And then they tune in and see that. Like, I mean, like, it's ridiculous. Like, I've coached young kids playing football, and and I've seen the way that they, you know, talk to referees and stuff like that at such a young age, and they get it. They get it from these superstars. So, yeah, I think it's something that major, you know, organisations in football like UEFA, FA, they can look at these kind of things and be stricter with the way they treat the referees. Because if you're a kid too, like, mate, do you want to become a referee if you're being treated, if you see that kind of thing, like, do you actually want to become a referee if you're just going to get yelled at the whole game and treated like
that? So I refereed one game in like elementary school.
Yeah.
And the teams didn't have different color jerseys, so you sort of had to know which player was on which team, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
So it was just like totally chaos. And after that game, I just, because they were surrounding me like that.
Yeah.
And after that game, I was just like, yeah, never going to do refereeing again.
Oh, mate, when I had to referee games in football, like literally like 8-year-old kids, maybe 10-year-old kids, and they spoke to me or just had a crack at me, I would just be like, can you just go sit out for like 1 minute? Like, it's just... Yeah, it's sad. It's sad because it's not really their fault, or I think it's more so like, you know, higher up in the game and the way they're role models, mate. And I think it's really bad. But I wanted to highlight one goal in the game by Salah. I know it was like literally in the last minute of stoppage time, but the strength he showed to hold off, I can't remember who the defender was.
Daniel James.
Okay, maybe it's not as great as I thought it was.
He's probably, if not faster, then he's at least as fast as Salah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it was like a pretty good like duel. Like, if you want to have one guy trying to catch him, I guess it should be Daniel James, because the others you pretty much outrun. So
No, it's very true. But yeah, I think he showed incredible strength to get through there and score that goal.
Liverpool's first goal was from a corner by Van Dijk. I thought it was pretty weird that they put Brandon Williams to man Mark Van Dijk for a corner.
Like,
it seemed like they learned for the next one, because then it was Maguire who was man marking him. Because I do think he's so much bigger of an aerial threat than the second best header at Liverpool. So I really think that, you know, you should put Maguire on him just straight from the beginning. And then if you're doing zone marking, then you sort of... you make the exception when you're playing against Van Dijk. And they didn't, and he ended up scoring. It also looked like Joe Gomez blocked off Maguire's run. So I guess that was on purpose. And if so, credits to the Liverpool set-piecing team, because that was a pretty good strategy. And something that the opposing teams always do against Van Dijk. So it's kind of nice to see that we're starting to do it too. And I think, if I remember correctly, Liverpool have 10 goals from set pieces this season, which is pretty incredible. Like, we're the best set piece team in the league. And it is something that they put a lot of effort into. It's not just Trent Alexander-Arnold has such a great foot and Van Dijk is such a good header. There are other players scoring goals from set pieces too.
Yeah.
And they're just organized so incredibly well. We haven't conceded a goal from a corner all season, which is probably even more incredible. Like, when Klopp took over, we were conceding, I don't know, like 5+ goals from corners every single season. And we just, every single game towards the end, if we were in the lead or if it got nervous, all of the Burnleys and everything, we just punch in long balls into the area, trying to win corners and then scoring goals from them and taking points off us. And they just completely managed to turn that around. Thanks to zonal marking, by the way, their commentators of sports, it actually works when you do it properly over time. So I think that's a very big strength of Liverpool. I also found it a bit interesting that Solskjaer mentioned that Liverpool were a long ball team in his press conference after the game, which got me a bit fired up, because Liverpool are a long ball team. They're also a possession team, a counter-attacking team, a set-piece team, a wing play team. So
and a winning team too?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So they do pretty much everything you need to do on the pitch. And
who was saying that? Gary Neville?
Huh?
Did you say Gary Neville was saying that?
Oh, no. That wasn't Gary Neville.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was Solskjaer saying they were a long ball team.
Oh.
Yeah. So I hope he doesn't actually believe that. And another thing I want to touch upon is something we talked about on our last podcast, and that is Solskjaer playing his best players in cup games.
Yes.
And guess what? It ended up with Rashford being injured and missing out on this game, and it turns out he's going to be out for at least a couple of weeks and potentially months, according to Winter. So
should have listened to Marius.
that's what you get from not doing it, because I'll touch a bit more upon that in the pods, which annoyed me this week. But overall great game of football, I think, even for like the neutral fans. And finally, I just want to sort of round it up with the expected goals from 538 from that game, just to sort of see, was this a deserved victory for Liverpool, or were they lucky? Alright, so Liverpool Man United, shot-based expected goals, 2.5 versus 1.3. So I guess a 2-1 would have been like a fair score in this game.
We'll move on to Arsenal, mate. We kind of talked last week, or at least I did, about how I think they've been quite unlucky with playing quite well but not getting the points they deserve. And I think it was basically the same kind of situation here. Maybe not saying that they played good enough to win the game or deserve to win the game, but they were very unlucky in terms of some of the calls and also the way that Sheffield United scored another deflection. So it's a bit, it's a terrible way to lose again.
What, or not lose a deflection? Again. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it was very slight. You have to look at a couple angles, or one of the angles, and you'll see that it was a deflection. I'm not sure if it was on target or not, if it didn't get deflected, but it's just very frustrating when you lose 2 weeks in a row, or you lose 4 points basically in two games from a deflection. And then on top of that, it was pretty obvious. I don't know if you saw it. VAR missed a penalty on Pepe. It was pretty obvious penalty. I mean, I can't remember who the defender was, but he stuck out his leg.
Did they miss it as in they looked at it and then failed to call it?
Yeah, they looked at it. Or they didn't. The referee didn't call a penalty, which obviously is a bad enough call. And then obviously VAR looked at it and didn't think it was clear and obvious, or whatever their wording is they like to use. I mean, if that's not clear and obvious, then what do we have to do? Like, does the defender literally have to come from behind and, like, you know, stamp on his calves or something like that? Like, it's just, I mean, it just highlights how farcical VAR really is. I mean, we've talked about this. Everyone's talked about how, you know, bad VAR has been.
The implementation of VAR, not VAR itself.
Yeah, no, you're right. You are right. It's just a bit frustrating when you lose a couple of points, which, you know, could have been gained just through, you know, a deflection again, and also a couple of bad calls from a referee. So, it's frustrating times, but then I guess once again, like, they did play okay. Sheffield United are an extremely good team. They are, I think people are giving them credit, but they are, I don't think they're getting enough credit, because the way they're set up and the way they're performing has been quite tremendous.
Their budget and everything coming as a newly promoted side, not even the winner of that Championship League, which was Norwich. It's just amazing. And Norwich won the league, and you can see where they are this season. So it's just absolutely incredible. And then they're being up there, being ahead of Tottenham and Arsenal in the table currently. It's just absolutely nuts.
I think they're better than that position too in the table. I'll talk about it later in terms of Fearless predictions, but I think they're a good chance of making it into the top six.
Yeah, I think their performance is almost like close to Leicester winning the league. I mean, of course, winning the league is going to be more sensational all the time, but just like the overperformance compared to their resources and sort of the position they had at the start of the table, being newly promoted and everything, it is just absolutely insane for them to have been doing this well, like, for 23 games now. It's incredibly strong. And I thought it was a very smart finish by Fleck in terms of hitting it into the ground. Because normally you don't see players doing that too often. And that was what was needed to sort of find a goal. So, very, very smart.
A bit. around that area where the goalkeeper spends a lot of time. So, yeah, very smart. But yeah, obviously a bit saddening for an Arsenal fan. But they are a good side. It's probably been the first time under Arteta in the Premier League where it was like just a good even game of football.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wasn't like, oh, you know, we were the better side and we should have won. It was more so just disappointing from the fact of, you know, those calls, that penalty call and just getting another deflection. It's just, and it was in the last 10 minutes too. Like, it's another game where we've lost in the last 10 minutes where we've been winning, or not lost, but drawn.
Yeah.
So
I guess in other like positives, Martinelli got another goal.
Well, I was about to say that is Martinelli. Like, look out for that kid, because he is tremendous. Like, I think it'll be really interesting to see what he does. Arteta does with the team when Aubameyang comes back, because Aubameyang, as good as he is, Martinelli is a better winger than Aubameyang.
Mm.
Martinelli should be on that left wing, I think. And then the question is whether you play Aubameyang or Lacazette, which is actually a tougher call than you think.
Really?
Because the way Arsenal have been playing,
mm-hmm.
Lacazette's been kind of used not as really a goal scorer. I'd say he's like reasonably similar to Firmino, the way Firmino plays.
Yeah.
I don't think Arteta's got Firmino in Arteta has Lacazette in the team to score goals. Like, I don't think he's like go out there and score as many goals as you can. I think he like likes him as that hold up play, exchanging balls with Ozil, more of like a, you know, a false nine, kind of like Firmino plays, and kind of relies on Mane and Salah to score the goals. So if Aubameyang comes back, they might have to like completely change the way they play, because Aubameyang's a goal scorer. And he's not really known for the way he distributes passes and holds up the ball or anything like that. So it'll be very, very interesting to see what Arteta does when Aubameyang comes back. Because, yeah, we need Aubameyang's goals, but Martinelli is a better winger. So unless you want to put them all in there, maybe that's the way to go. Maybe they put Martinelli in for Pepe, but then you haven't got a left side, you know, left-footed winger coming in from the right. So
yeah, and you don't give your very expensive summer signing a chance to keep on settling in the team and in the Premier League, which you probably want to do. So it's a tricky one, but at least it is good that there are a couple of players who are good.
So, yeah, it's a good headache, isn't it?
It's one of those luxury problems.
Yeah.
I also found it interesting that Saka put in that amazing cross, which Martinelli scored off. Because, I mean, he's playing left back now, so totally out of position. But he's getting game time, and surely that is going to benefit him next year and the season after.
Yeah.
Because I think when I've seen him playing as a winger, I think he looks like a tremendous talent as well.
So, yeah, we've got some really good youngsters coming through, mate. That's the exciting thing. And if you looked at our defensive back four from the week, it was very interesting. Like Maitland-Niles, although he has been playing a lot of football at right back, he didn't start there, his career there. And then you had Mustafi and Louise in the middle, which is like just about the most scary centre-back partnership you could think of. And then we had Saka on the left at left back. So it is a very makeshift back four until we get the likes of Tierney, Socrates,
Kolasinac
back. So, I mean, overall it's okay. But, yeah, just disappointing to not be getting these points because of, like, you know, factors that sometimes you can't really control.
Yeah, that's how football is. There is a lot of randomness in it. And I also wanted to mention that expected goals had this as a 1.1 versus 1.1. So I guess a 1-1 draw was like fair if you... But I mean, obviously that doesn't account for like the VAR calls and stuff like that.
No.
So, if you feel that they were wrong, then you do have a reason to feel a bit cheated. But yeah.
Yeah. All right. Leicester City lost again. They were up against Burnley 1-0. But they failed to deliver once again. Is it their second or third loss in a row? I'm not too sure. But they lost against Southampton last week, and they're going through a bit of a rough patch at the moment, which we kind of knew would come at some point. Like, you can't, with the squad that they have, it's going to get tired, and they're going to, you know, incur some sort of bad form throughout the season. It's not, you know, it's nothing dire at the moment. Like, it's not like, you know, they're going to drop out of the top four or like You know, it's not like they're playing the kind of football that's, you know, ugly to watch or anything like that. So what's your take on Leicester at the moment, mate? Is it panic stations?
No, I think they'll just keep on doing what they're doing. I mean, as we just mentioned, there is a lot of like randomness in football, and you're not going to win every week. I think it also just shows like how difficult it actually is to win every week in the Premier League, because the traditional top teams are all dropping points left and right.
Yeah.
And that just, it's not just like, okay, it happened like 2 weekends or something like that. It's been happening all throughout the season. We're more than halfway done. So my conclusion now is that, you know, this is a much, much more even Premier League than what it's been in many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And yeah, people can say, oh, it's a weekly Liverpool are sort of running away with the title and everything, but they won the Champions League last season. They are like a historically very, very good team. And I think like pretty much like every single team, if you look at their squad, there are some very, very good players in there. Crystal Palace have Saha, who's like the main star there. Everton have Richarlison, and at Brighton, like Maupay has been pretty good this season scoring goals. And if you look at West Ham, I guess they haven't like totally overperformed some of the players there, like Fornals and Haller. He scored a couple of goals like early in the season. And then Watford have like Delafeu, Aston Villa have Grealish. So there's like there's good players in pretty much every single team.
Yeah.
And now I just mentioned sort of the top players, but like every team has like at least 2 to 3 players who would be good enough to at least be on the bench for pretty much any other team in the league. And I don't think that was the case like years ago, that there were so many good players in like all of the clubs. But that's just the advantage that English football has been able to accumulate over the years by making so much more money than every single other club, and then just bringing in all of the good talent.
Yeah, I think like if you look back on the Premier League like 5-6 years ago, it was kind of like your big six clubs, and then number seven was Everton, and there was no one else. Yeah. Like it was a massive gap after that. Now you've got Wolves, Sheffield United, you can put Crystal Palace into that argument because they've had a lot of injuries. They're still sitting in ninth.
Yeah.
You've got Everton. I mean, the list goes on and on of these like quality teams that have that kind of like, you know, if you come mid-table in the Premier League, it's actually like a very good achievement. And it's also the drop-off of the likes of Chelsea, Arsenal, Man United, Tottenham. Like, it's made the league very, very interesting. So, yeah, no, it definitely isn't panic stations for Leicester City. I'm looking at the table here now. They've got an 11-point gap to Manchester United in fifth. So they have lost 2 games in a row now. So it's, you know, it's only 2 games, and they've got, like I just said, they've got a massive buffer until Manchester United. So it's not like Brendan Rodgers is going to rock up to training on Monday morning and be like, come on guys, we've got to kick back into gear. Like, this is not good enough. Like, he can relax, and just implement those things back into the team. They're also missing, Ndidi at the moment, Wilfred Ndidi, pivotal part of their team. It's like the equivalent of, you know, like a Arsenal losing Torreira at the moment or something like that. Yeah. Just a massive part of their team. He just breaks up that play beautifully for them. So, get him back into the team. I'm not sure how long he's out for, but...
Yeah. I mean, part of what's also impressed me with Leicester was that they were even able to win the games when Vardy was not playing. Because then he Nacho stepped up and James Maddison scored a goal and... Yeah, they were winning those games. So,
yeah.
I mean, at some point, you are going to, like, drop points. Manchester City did it again. And that's just how it is in the Premier League this year. And so, yeah, it's part of the game, and there's no reason to panic there. Just keep on doing what they're doing, which has been working incredibly well for them so far. They were overperforming the metrics a bit, like the expected goals metrics. So, it's was expected to see a little bit of a drop off at some point, and Manchester City is like statistically like the second best team in this league, and now they are back in second. But taking third place this year for Leicester is a tremendous achievement, and it looks like they will still be able to hold on to that.
Yeah, because we were saying that like they're one Vardy injury away from like an absolute collapse. But if you look at their squad, they've got Iheanacho there, so they've got a bit of cover there for Vardy, but they've also got some decent cover in midfield too. Like on the weekend, they had Timmermans on the bench. So
yeah, sure.
It's more so, I'd say, the defense, that if they get an injury at like right back or left back, even if they lose someone like a Sinyonku, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but that's when I think they might be in a bit of trouble, like defensively, if they get a few injuries there. So they're doing very well.
Yeah, and then Wolverhampton managed to pull off like a win despite being two goals down against Southampton. So that was a pretty incredible. And they are currently in sixth, even points with Manchester United, just 5 points out of those of Chelsea in the Champions League spot. Very, very impressive by Wolverhampton. I mean, they've been playing in the Europa League too this season, managed to progress from their group. So they had it a lot tougher with more games this year, and still they're right up there. So that's another club which has just done so many smart decisions in like the transfer market. Obviously, having close connections to Jorge Mendes helps them with bringing in all of those amazing players. But yeah, extremely impressive performance by Wolves. So very, very well deserved place for them so far.
Yeah, no, it's a fun league, the EPL, mate. Very, very fun. All right, so I wanted to highlight also that there is actually a big game coming up, Chelsea and Arsenal, on Tuesday night. I think this is not going to get the attention that it deserves, but it's actually quite a big game because they only just played each other like a couple of weeks ago for one, and it's already turning around. But Chelsea are in pretty ordinary form. Arsenal probably in a little bit better form. But in terms of the top four, it's actually quite a big game because although Chelsea are 10 points ahead of Arsenal, if Arsenal can win this game, that makes it 7 points. And with the form that Chelsea are in compared to like Arsenal, who, you know, seem to be on the rise at the moment, if Arsenal won, I think it would make things very, very interesting. So, yeah, look forward to that game in midweek.
Yeah, I mean, if Arsenal manage to win two, then Manchester United win.
Yeah.
And then they are only 2 points off the Champions League spot.
Yeah.
So there is a lot left to play for in the Premier League this season, and it's going to be a race for the finish line for like that last top four spot. So it will be interesting. I still have Chelsea as the favourites for it, obviously because they have 5 points, but also because in 23 games they managed to pull off 3 more wins than all of the other teams besides the teams that are above them in the table. So I think that gives them an edge.
Yeah, and although their form seemed bad, I'm just looking at it now, they have managed to get 2 wins in their last 5 games. One of them was against Arsenal, and I didn't think they deserved to win that at all. But no, at least they're getting the 3 points. That's all that matters. Big game there. And you wanted to say something about Barcelona.
Yeah, so it was a bit funny that Barcelona, sort of out of nowhere, at least for people who don't watch Barcelona play every single week, fired Valverde. And because if they were to fire him, then surely the time would have been like after that Liverpool turnaround last year. that would have been perfect timing. Everyone would have accepted that. But the president doesn't like him and has wanted to get rid of him for a long time and finally did so. I thought the funny part was that when they fired him, it didn't seem like they actually had a plan. So they tried getting in Xavi, who turned him down. They tried getting in Iniesta, who turned him down. And they tried getting in Pochettino, who apparently has said that he would rather like work on a farm than manage Barcelona. So then they ended up going with like their fourth or fifth choice in the end, being like Setien. And he only got like a short-term contract. I think it was 18 months. With a clause that if the president, who is very likely to lose the next election for Barcelona, ends up losing the election, then the next president can fire him. So it's just like, for such a big club, it seems like they just have such poor management these days. And that is very surprising with the resources and everything that they have at hand. They made the most money out of all the football clubs in the world last year. Since it's always a year behind, according to like the Deloitte money ranking. And yeah, it just seems like a mess. Like their transfer strategy hasn't really been coherent over the last couple of years. They need central defenders for one, and they still buy like Griezmann for almost 100 million euros. So it's just a lot of room for improvement there. But it's good for teams like Liverpool, I guess, that they're unstable, because as long as you have Messi in the team, you should be a Champions League favorite pretty much every single year.
Yeah, it's been a while since they've won the Champions League, Barcelona, isn't it? And they maybe they've lost their aura a bit. And I mean, the La Liga's lost its aura a bit the last couple of years, because, you know, them and Real Madrid haven't been as dominant the last year and a half.
Yeah.
Just in European football. So the most attractive places to go to now are Liverpool and Manchester City. So they've got the big, you know, blue chip now at the moment, you know, the big blue chip stocks. So yeah, no, it's dangerous times for Barcelona. For such a historic club, it's quite shocking.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, mate. What got you fired up this week?
My mate saying that Liverpool got lucky with injuries.
Friends, mate. They're the worst.
They are the worst. Sitting there as the United fan and saying, oh, yeah, we missed Pogba for all season. Yeah, he doesn't want to play. Which is quite apparent.
He was at a fashion show in Paris this last week.
It wouldn't have been too much better if he was playing, so don't worry too much about that one. The other, like, being stuff like Rashford. I didn't think about mentioning that, but, like, Rashford just got injured because he played in a cup game when he had apparently a fracture in his back before playing in a game. And playing in a game, guess what? Made it worse, and now he's going to miss a couple of weeks to a couple of months.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you reap what you sow, is an old saying. And if you play your players in every single cup game that you play, they are going to pick up injuries. So I just think that a lot of United's injuries are self-inflicted. And those are the sort of injuries that you could avoid. Liverpool are pretty good at rotating their midfield, which are the players who do the most running. And then they don't rotate their forwards that much, but they are very, very good at, like, they give the players as many rest days as humanly possible. Just complete days off. Like, the fitness staff and everything are just very much world-class too, not just the players. And, yeah, speaking of injuries, like, they have any injuries. Like, Alisson missed, like, 7 games at the start of the season. And then Fabinho missed 2 months now. Matip's been out for 2-3 months, and he was the amazing defender last season, one of the best in the Premier League. So every team's going to miss him. And yeah, Ox has been injured, Keita's injured constantly. Shaqiri, who's one of the players who should come in when all the players are injured, has been injured, so he hasn't gotten the game time when he was needed. Lovren's been injured. We're down to Gomez, who looked like he was the fourth choice center back at the start of the season, which was surprising to me, but still, like, injuries take their toll. Miller's out now. So yeah, Liverpool have had injuries too, is just my point. And yeah, you can't help when someone is breaking your leg, but when the hamstrings go, like they did for Harry Kane, then those are the sort of stuff that is avoidable by, like, managing the fitness of the player well. And also buying players who are not very injury prone is usually a good strategy. So yeah, I can't be fired up.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough, mate. I don't know who your mate is, but you should get rid of him. He's got a bad opinion there. And what got me fired up, it's not really like a weekly thing. It's kind of just a general view I have on the EPL or just football at the moment. Some of the big clubs in England, like a Manchester United comes to mind, and Arsenal more so, is their recruitment policies. And I look back at Arsenal's the way they've recruited, like, the last, you know, 2 years, and their best players have been like 18, 19-year-olds that they've picked up from like bottom leagues or at least small leagues in Europe or Brazil and stuff like that. So I look at the likes of Martinelli, picked him up from Brazil. I don't even think he was playing in the top league there. Young player, and he's probably been one of their best buyers in the last 2 years. You look at Guendouzi, another player. He came from League Two in France, although he's, like, not this incredible player yet. For the fact that we picked him up as an 18, 19-year-old, like, he's overperforming at the moment from, you know, what you would expect from someone like him.
Great talent.
Yeah, exactly. And then on top of that, like Torreira too, he came from Sampdoria in Italy. Not really that well known, and they only picked him up for like something between 10 to 15 million. So I'm questioning a lot of the big clubs' recruitment policies, because it seems like they're a bit lazy. Like they're just going for those like big names that are quite obvious, that are like a fan friendly signing. Whereas like Manchester United, they went out and got a guy like James from Swansea City, which at the time everyone's like, well, what kind of signing is that? But it's a good signing. Like they got him, you know, reasonably cheap, and he's proved to be a good signing. So I'm just not really rating like these big signings like a Pepe and stuff like that, where you just spend lots of money on a person that it is a bit risky. And Pepe only had like really one good season in the League One with Lille. So
with a lot of penalties too.
Yeah, exactly. And they play a counter-attacking style, and that's where he scored all of his goals from. So and Arsenal don't play like that. So I think in general, like big clubs are just there, like Arsenal and Manchester United. I think a lot of the time over the years, they've been really, really lazy with their recruitment. And I'd rather you get someone like a bit cheaper, like a Guendouzi, like a Martinelli, and you've actually done some real good homework on them. So like nowadays, when I see someone like Martinelli get signed, I'm like, oh, okay, I actually get more excited by that. Because for you to sign someone like that, it means that you've really looked into their development, and you've looked at all the games they played and stuff. Whereas maybe when you sign someone like a Pepe, you've just seen like a highlights package or something like that, and you've just seen the games where he's really performed well, and you've just looked at one season. You haven't looked at his whole career. So yeah, that's something that's, and it kind of comes up with the likes of, you know, Jadon Sancho coming. Like, he's going to cost a lot of money, like hundreds of millions of pounds.
He's probably worth it though, but I think it's also a lot more fun to see like those players coming through, because you sort of see like step by step, and you see the progression and everything. I still think that it's probably worth it to pay sort of that premium for like the very, very best players, because they are extremely difficult to find and are rather unique. So a guy like Sancho is probably worth like the 100 million that whichever team is going to put down on him. And most likely, like even that will probably end up being a good price, as he has 10 good years ahead of him.
Yeah.
But sort of these signings like Pepe, they are sort of the tricky ones, because you are paying a big fee, but there is no guarantee that the fee is actually going to match up with sort of the intrinsic or actual value of the player once they get settled.
Yeah.
That's the tricky part.
Another one's like Maguire too. Like Maguire's good, but is he really worth, what is he, 80, 90 pounds, a million pounds that he came for? Like, no way is he worth that. And if I was United, I'd rather invest like a way smaller sum, like, you know, less than 10-20 million on like a younger centre back that you think, like, give a year or so, is going to be just as good as Maguire, if not better. I mean, they obviously have the money to spend, but Arsenal maybe don't in that case. So yeah, it's not worked out with Pepe so far. I hope it does, obviously, but I'd rather my club spend less money and find a player that they really like, rather than really risk those big sums of money on a player that, you know, looks really good, but it's not a guaranteed thing. I think when you're spending that kind of money, you have to know the ins and outs of this player and know that he is going to be a very, very good player.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. So first, you just got to start with like the overall strategy. Like, how do you want your team to play? And they should be like, they aim to play that way for the next 10 years. So that regardless of the managers and the players or whatever you bring in, you are still playing that way. If you're playing 4-3-3, you should bring in coaches who are used to coaching 4-3-3. You shouldn't be bringing in like a 4-2-3-1 coach or like a 3-5-2 coach. You don't bring in Antonio Conte if you want to play 4-3-3. It's really that simple. And those are sort of like the basic mistakes that just surprises me that these players are able to do, that these clubs are able to do. But that's sort of the start. And then the second part is you should buy players which fit into that overall strategy. It's like you said, like if Pepe is best on the counter-attack, then ideally you should not buy him, but you should be buying a player who's used to playing for a top team and like breaking down defenses when they try to park the bus. Of course, like it's possible for players to be coached to do that, and good chance Pepe will come good. Like a lot of Liverpool players needed a season to settle, so
yeah, definitely.
Still time for him, and he might be an amazing winger going forward. But you should like recruit the players who actually fit the style that you want to play. Because otherwise, because you pay such a big price tag, you will sort of be forced to play that player even when it doesn't make your team better. Like Arsenal, like playing Martinelli instead of one of the other players you mentioned, like Lacazette, Aubameyang, or Pepe, is probably better for the team because he has the right attitude. He's working hard and he's looking like a tremendous talent. So that's sort of it. And then also wanted to touch upon, I think there also are some exceptions when it comes to like position. The positions where I would be wanting to spend big and bring in established players, that would be goalkeepers and central defenders. Over the years, Liverpool have had so many like talented central defenders, which they brought in, never ended up playing for anything but the Liverpool reserves, and then ended up going to like a different club. And then at the time they turned like 25, 26, they were actually pretty good defenders. Like Mikel San Jose is one guy that stands out. I can't remember whether it's Bilbao or Sociedad or wherever he ended up playing, but only played for Liverpool reserves and ended up being like a La Liga quality central defender. And there were a couple of other examples like that. Gabriel Paletta in Italy, he played for one of the Milan teams. And another player who just Benitez brought in and only played in reserves and then ended up being good. So getting young central defenders in is extremely difficult, and it's also a position where if they make mistakes, it is going to cost you points. If a Martinelli loses the ball, then this is not nearly as dangerous because they can have plenty of chances to sort of recover it. So yeah, that's my view on it at least.
Yeah, no, it's cool, mate. All right, we'll move on to trading places. This week, well, it's kind of a follow-on from a lot of my thoughts on the likes of Arsenal and Manchester United. Bit of a different one. If you had to choose to be a club, so maybe let's just say you're a fan or something like that and you had to support one of these teams, Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs, or Manchester United, like who do you like at the moment? Like who do you think out of those four massive clubs is going to take that next step and get out of this hole over the next few years? Like, who would you want to be supporting?
For me, there's two clubs that stand out here and two clubs that don't stand out too much. And the first would be Chelsea, because this year they have all those homegrown talents being played into the team. It's like English players. I think if I supported Chelsea, it would be tremendously fun to sort of watch them progress and just being able to establish themselves into the team. They have Reece James in defense. They have Hudson-Odoi now getting game time as a winger. And then they have Tammy Abraham, which has just had his breakthrough season. Mason Mount has looked like an amazing prospect. He kind of looks like a young Lampard, I think, in parts of a game, like especially his shooting. It just looks like Lampard just taught him what to do, and he studied him and just wants to replicate like his hero. So that I found like pretty amazing. And then they also have a guy like Loftus-Cheek, who's like missed most of the season through injury. So it's just like so many homegrown players there, and then seeing them sort of grow with the team, and if they can add to those with like a couple of foreign great players like they've done over the years, then I think that's a tremendously fun team to watch, especially with that English core. Second would be Arsenal. I think I'll just do it in this priority because they have also so many exciting like prospects. I think Guendouzi is a good player. I really like him. I like Torreira, even though he's older. He's not really a talent anymore. And then you have Saka, Martinelli, who I really like. Both of those players, would really wish to have them in my club. And there's a couple of others who I'm not sure like how they will turn out, but like Reece Nelson played in the Bundesliga last year, and then you have Nkitia, who's I guess doing pretty good with Leeds, and
he's come back on loan like literally last week.
So there's there's so many good like talents at Arsenal, so I would think I would very much enjoy watching them progress too.
Mm.
And then Spurs versus United, I think that's tricky. Yeah, Spurs under Pochettino, definitely go Spurs. Spurs under Mourinho. Oof.
The thing is that I think at least Man United have the money to get themselves out of this hole.
Yeah.
And they are kind of heading in the right direction, I guess. It's just, I guess, for me at least, the biggest question mark is Solskjaer the man to take them ahead?
Yeah.
But Spurs, I think they're on a downward spiral. Like, you don't really see much uplift at the moment other than getting Kane back from injury.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there they have, I guess, Sessegnon and Foyt, who are like promising youngsters. And Sessegnon is not a player which I'm very excited to sort of see get a chance, because he scored like, I guess, 15 goals in the championship when he was like 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
So that was just totally amazing. And yeah, it's going to be exciting to see him. But besides those, I don't know, like Skip maybe. There's not as many exciting youngsters. Tanganga is playing a bit now, but he's a central defender playing left back, so I'm not sure like how sustainable that is. And also, defenders doesn't get me as excited as the forward players.
Mm.
So yeah, I think I would actually, at this stage, I think I would actually rather go Man United, which is which is something I never thought I'd say. But they have some exciting talent coming through as well, like being able to see like Rashford, who's going to be good for like the next 10 years, and then Greenwood is probably going to be good for the next 15 years. Brandon Williams looks like a very exciting prospect on left back. They have some very good talent at Manchester United.
But yeah, Chelsea, Arsenal's the way to go. Sounds like a good trading place.
Yeah, and then I kind of also, I think I would enjoy the challenge of seeing Manchester United sort of rise back to the top.
Yeah.
Since they're currently, you know, underperforming so much since Ferguson left.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's always part of what it's been like being a Liverpool fan, just supporting kind of an underdog, trying to punch above their weight.
Yeah.
And although it can be tough at times when you're not winning trophies and stuff like that, when you finally do win it, though, it just feels so amazing.
Yeah.
So it's totally worth the shot. And I think psychologically it's more fun being a supporter of a team which finally wins after so many years of struggle than being a Bayern Munich or Juventus where you just win every single season.
Yeah, definitely. And who you got for me, mate?
Yeah, so my question is, there's a player called Boubacary Soumaré, plays in Ligue 1, and he's currently being linked, I guess, for Lille. And he's currently being linked to both Chelsea and Manchester United.
Mm.
So it's not so much about him, but it's rather like, if you are a young, promising talent these days, would you rather go to Manchester United or would you rather go to Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of have two opinions on this, because if I'm this guy, Boubacary Soumaré.
Yeah.
If I'm him, I would actually choose Manchester United just because I am a defensive midfielder. Chelsea have got both Kante and Jorginho.
Yeah.
They're both 28 in the prime of their career. They're not going to be, you know, it's going to be really hard to push them out of the team. Unless maybe if one of them's thinking of going, then I probably would go to Chelsea. But if they're staying put there, I would go to Manchester United just on that reason. But in general, yeah, I don't want to be going to Manchester United at the moment. I don't really think they're heading in the right direction, to be honest. Whereas Chelsea, I think they actually have a clear strategy in place, and I like Frank Lampard. I think he's like the man to take them forward.
Mm.
And he's getting a lot out of these young players who seem quite inspired by him. Yeah, if in terms of like what club I would rather join, I think, as you were just saying there, I think Chelsea are much more on the up than Manchester United are. I still think Manchester United are all over the place. Like, to be honest, I like I said before, I don't really rate Solskjaer. I don't think he's the man to take them forward. And if he leaves, then what happens to like their plan? Does it, you know, does it all start all over again? Ed Woodward, don't rate him at all. Their recruitment has been quite poor, I think. The last 5 or 6 years, their recruitment's been very bad. Manchester United, the likes of Paul Pogba, Sanchez, Schweinsteiger, all these guys that have come in and just really haven't performed for the money that they're on. So they, you know, you saw some good changes with the likes of you know, James coming in. Maguire's a good signing, but the money is ridiculous. Even Wan-Bissaka, like, he's a good player, but the money's ridiculous there too. So yeah, I in general, if I'm a young player, I'm looking at Chelsea. But in the case of this guy, I guess I would go to Manchester United, just because Paul Pogba's probably going to leave soon. McTominay's their only real, like, decent, I don't know if even if he is a defensive midfielder, but, like, you know, decent midfielder there going forward. So yeah, I'd probably go to Manchester United if I am Boubacari Samari.
All right.
Yeah.
Quiz question next. Yeah. All right, so let me try and think who might have gotten relegated. Because it's just like, was it this year? Was it the year before? Or so I think I'm going to go Huddersfield.
Correct.
And who on earth else was it in the Premier League? Because what's so weird these years is that the teams which are getting relegated, majority of them don't look like they're going to get straight back up. The majority of them just fall, like, straight to the bottom, like Stoke did when they got relegated, and Huddersfield's been struggling.
Yeah.
And I guess Cardiff is another.
Correct. That's the one.
Okay. And then the last one is Fulham.
Oh, he's so, killed it. Well done.
They are, like, the only one which is in the promotion fight this year. So I guess they were, like, the only one who were doing something that was sustainable.
Yeah.
And Mitrovic is, like, a shared top scorer in the championship this year, so he's been doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And almost scoring goal per game. Or I guess it's a bit off since they're playing one game today, but it's still pretty good. All right, so thank you guys for watching. If you have questions for us or things that you would like us to cover on this podcast, then please give us a comment and we will totally address that. So this is your chance to get a question answered on air. And if you like this video and want us to make more videos like this, please give us a like and also subscribe to our channel, and we will know that people are enjoying what we're doing, and we will keep making videos like this. So have a good week, and see you next time.
See you guys. With